From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Eli Hastings is the author of two memoirs, and he's a team leader at the Pongo Teen Writing Project. Pongo is a nonprofit that works with troubled Seattle teens on how to express themselves through poetry and other forms of writing. Eli's memoirs, Fallen Room and Clearly Now the Rain, deal with how mental disorder and addiction has affected his life. Eli is finishing up his MA in marriage and family therapy. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
In your most recent memoir, Clearly Now the Rain, you allude early on in the book to a disturbed friend you tried to help who became a full-fledged schizophrenic. You leave on a road trip partly, as you write, to get away from your guilt about not being able to help. And then you end up entranced by a woman who's got her own addiction problems and mental disorders. Some people flee when they meet people who have these problems. Obviously, there was a repelling and attracting going on for these people in your life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great question or a great thing to point out. I've always wondered sort of why and how I've ended up surrounded by people that are struggling with mental illness and substance abuse issues. And I think it will be a lifelong examination for me to be able to say why exactly that is. But I will say this, I feel like the various experiences I've had with loved ones who have struggled with mental health or substance abuse issues have opened me more to it rather than closed me to it.
What do you mean opened you? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that when you're talking about substance abuse or you're talking about mental illness, you're also talking about grief and you're also talking about some amount of trauma, usually either in the lives of the people that you love or possibly in the relationships that you share with them. And my belief about trauma and grief is that it either closes people down or it opens them up. And I think that most people tend to sort of withdraw and become more callous the more that they're exposed to that sort of thing. And I think that many of us that are in the healing professions and the serving and helping professions are the people who feel more opened and more tender and sort of more compassionate as a result of what they experience.
And you've kind of moved in that direction, but at one point you're a civilian, you're just a person, and you're running into people who have these issues with them. And as I was reading through the book, I was thinking what your thoughts were on how much a friend can help in situations like that, because mental illness and addiction problems, they're relating to a person like that is not your usual friend relationship. In fact, there's a lot of things inherent in substance abuse and mental illness that make it really hard to be a friend in the conventional sense. Can a friend help? How can a friend help?
That's a great question, Ross. I will say this, and this is something that has come very clear to me only over time and only through both personal relationships and clinical work, which is that you can help, but you can't save anybody. And I think that, if I had to put a tagline on my memoir, it would be about loving someone that you cannot save. And so, having, in a clinical sense, having your boundaries around what you can and cannot do for your clients, and as well in your personal life, having those same boundaries, though they may look a little bit different, is very important. So, I mean, my belief is that you can serve people by alleviating their suffering, but you can't serve people by changing things for them so that they survive.
How do you figure out as a friend or as a family member what you can do and what you can't do? I mean, there's the classic case of the parents whose child is abusing drugs and they shut the child out. They don't give them any more money. Maybe they even throw them out of the house. That's a line that is drawn in certain instances. Can you think of other, and maybe you don't think that's a good line to be drawn. Like, how do you draw a line like that over someone you care for deeply?
I love that question too, because obviously I come up against this a lot in my clinical work. One answer to that question might be that in some families, cutting a child off, quote unquote, might be the best thing for the child and the family. However, in my view of the way families work, that doesn't necessarily mean it's because the child is lost or the child is hopeless. In far more cases, it's that the problem is actually in the family system and not in the child. Working with youth, we get a preponderance of clients who are sort of delivered to us with an attitude that sounds something like, my kid is screwed up, please fix him or her. And, you know, I come from a family systems background, and my degree will be in family therapy. So we look at families as a system. And once you get used to looking at families as a system, you see that the problems are very, very rarely intrapersonal, i.e. within the mind or the soul of one given member, mm-hmm. and are actually part of the system.
How did you deal with that personally? As I mentioned in your memoir, you talk about something, a friend of yours who developed schizophrenia, and you just wanted to kind of get away because you felt badly about how you were not able to help. And then the bulk of the memoir is about a young woman who you became really attracted to and infatuated with, who also in some ways was spiraling downward. But that was a relationship that stayed around for much longer. It didn't appear as though you were running away from that.
No, and I love this question, because the continuum sort of between my first best friend and who became sort of my second best friend, I guess you would put it, is very interesting. You know, schizophrenia is a far different ball of wax than severe depression or substance abuse. You know, schizophrenia doesn't have a cure, and in fact, it has basically a genetic component to it. It's very, very hard to maintain a relationship with somebody who's actively psychotic or delusional. My friend Sarala, about whom this book was in a very different category. Her diagnosis in terms of mental health was never clear, nor was I overly concerned about what it was or interested in it. I would actually say that I viewed my friend Sarala's struggle as something more spiritual than psychological. And the way that she engaged that struggle was also one of the greatest lessons of my life, in terms of her showing how you could love even as you suffered.
Give me an example of how she showed that to you.
There was a time when she was in a relationship that was falling apart, and she was pretty far down the road of one of her various stints with heroin. She was, I believe, in an abusive relationship with someone who was supplying her drugs, and my father died. She was at my side 24 hours later, and she was there for the next 3 days, and she didn't have a lot to say. She just stood by me and sort of warned others off when they got a little too close.
Wow. And maybe he wasn't using then?
I don't know.
But the fact she was there, she represented him.
Yeah, I don't know. If I had to guess, I'd say she probably was. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't an impediment to her loving me or supporting me.
Eli Hastings is talking about his memoir, Clearly Now, The Rain, and his work. He lives in Seattle with a wife and a toddler. His most recent book, published in May, Clearly Now, The Rain. When you're writing a memoir, how do you deal with the urge to shade the truth, both for a better story and also just to sort of, I don't want to say that. I mean, I don't want to hurt this person. I don't want to put that out there. How do you balance those things?
That's a tremendous question. I wish we had another couple hours. You know, I went through an MFA program in North Carolina several years ago, and the bulk of what we argued, debated, and dissected in the classrooms of that program was this question about nonfiction and where, you know, where the line is between fiction and nonfiction, what are the ethics of our genre, et cetera, et cetera. You know, briefly, I would say that what I did with this book, and I think with my first book, Falling Room, as well, was to be as kind as I possibly could to everyone while not being dishonest.
Can you be kind and be truthful?
Yes.
Okay. And I'll just have to read that to find out about it. It's really interesting to me. You're working with this Pongo Teen Writing Project. These are kids who are in trouble. Some of these kids have been in jail, or they're in other ways at risk. And you're working at getting them to write about their own experiences. I mean, do you talk about your own experiences writing about yourself as a way to kind of get them interested in writing about themselves?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I'm joining with a youth, whether it be in my clinical work or with a Pongo youth, I share my own story frequently. I think strategically, but frequently. And I believe in writing and healing personally, because, you know, writing has saved my own life before. So that's definitely an entree point for me in terms of engaging and interfacing with youth. You know, Pongo has been around for 18 years. We've worked with thousands and thousands and thousands of youth. We've published, I think, 12 volumes of youth poetry that we distribute in the community. And what we find at the core of Pongo's work is that when we're working with incarcerated youth or youth in a psychiatric setting, 80-85% of them are often traumatized, some of them actively, many with multiple traumas. And what we believe and what we found is that the act of writing poetry and creating art and using narrative is an integrating experience. And there's a lot of research out right now looking at the use of narrative in dealing with trauma. Because trauma is a fragmenting experience, the use of compiling traumatic events into a narrative that makes sense and is coherent is often extremely healing. So that's sort of at the core of Pongo's work, as well as sort of the core of what I've done in my own personal life.
You know, it just makes total sense. I mean, working with traumatic youth or anyone, writing something down about your experience, even in a journal, externalizes it in some way and allows you to set it over here and take a look at it.
Exactly.
Instead of having it continually roil about in your head.
That's exactly right. And I mean, that's the simple catharsis piece for sure. Mm. And that's why, you know, millions of Americans write in journals still to this day. When it comes to trauma, there's more complex sort of interventions or carefully designed activities that you can use to help people build that narrative when they're having more trouble.
Can you give an example? You don't need to use names, of course, but how this has worked. Like someone, a youth you might have worked with that had a traumatic experience or some other experience in which in the act of writing poetry or other writing, they were able to help them deal better with that experience.
Absolutely. One of the troubles I have with giving anecdotes about Pongo is that we are not allowed to follow up with these youth afterwards. So my impression of how this worked with this one young woman is anecdotal, but I'll give it anyway. She was a 13-year-old girl in juvenile detention. She was about 5 feet tall. She had severe learning disabilities, and she didn't want to work with us for several weeks, and eventually she agreed to. She sat down, and we used a poem model that we call I Just Thought You Should Know. And what it is it's a letter to a loved one or someone who is in your life that you can't reach anymore. And so this young woman wrote a letter to her mother, and it was about 2 pages long. A lot of it I can't say on the air, but it was the main thrust of it, repeated many times, was I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. I hate you for leaving me alone. I hate you for packing my nose full of cocaine when I was 7 to see what would happen. I hate you for letting all of your boyfriends have their way with me. The very last line of the poem, she didn't really know what to do. She paused for a minute and she wrote, I just thought you should know that you're my mother and I will always love you. And she started crying and she said, it doesn't make any sense. And I said, it does make sense. And even if it didn't, it doesn't matter. This is the human experience. You can both hate and love your mother. And, you know, what I saw in her eyes at that point told me that it had been meaningful to her, and I hope it contributed to her healing, though I never saw her again.
Wow. I wonder if she ever shared that with her mother.
I do, too.
There's a scene in Clearly Now, The Rain, where you ask the doomed Sarala if writing poetry helps her spirit, if it makes her feel more human. And she just turns around and she's really angry at you for even asking the question. And when I read that part of the book, I was thinking, this is so interesting because this is what you do now.
Exactly. She didn't want to answer that question because she didn't want to acknowledge that she was doing anything that would help her heal. And the reason for that is that she wanted me to be very clear and very prepared for the fact that she would die. And so when it came to me either pushing, you know, palliative things upon her or inquiring about how she got by through this experience or that experience, she was very dismissive because she didn't want to adhere herself to any kind of hope that would therefore hurt me more when she went.
Eli Hastings, thanks very much for joining us. The memoir, most recent of his, is called Clearly Now, The Rain.